Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today. People have long puzzled over the Maya civilization's rise to glory and fall to ruin. The latest thinking is that a man named Fire is Born made the Maya great, but no person or problem caused the collapse. Simply put, everything went wrong. The splendor of the Maya unfolded against the backdrop of the rainforests of southern Mexico and Central America. Here, classic Maya civilization reached improbable heights with pre-classic roots that date back 3,000 years. Guy Gugliotta is the author of The Maya Glory and Ruin, a saga of a civilization in three parts of the August edition of National Geographic magazine. The rise, the monumental splendor, and the collapse. What caused the collapse? Warfare, overpopulation, environmental damage, drought, extravagance. We'll find out. Guy, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure, Jim.
I know that you have spent a lot of time in the Mayan Empire because of this great article that you wrote for National Geographic.
Yes, I have spent quite a number of weeks in Guatemala, and also I've been to southern Mexico, Honduras, Belize, most of the countries where the Maya were, and still live.
There's a fine map which illustrates the city-states of the Maya, including the pre-classic, the classic, and the post-classic, and so you can sort of see where things began and the most recent settlements that occurred.
Exactly. I guess archaeologists have divided the Maya up into pre-classic, classic, and post-classic for quite some time, just for convenience sake. I think we tend to reckon that the pre-classic ended pretty much with the beginning of the so-called Maya long count, which is the when we're able to see the dating of particular events and the introduction of Mayan script. And then when the long count disappears and the script becomes very sporadic, then that becomes the post-classic. So you have sort of rise and then sort of the apogee and then finally decline.
And for most people, they only, know of the Maya and really don't know the history. And do we know exactly what happened to end the Mayan civilization as a large civilization?
Not really. I think that most scholars, I think, would say now or would go for kind of a combination of circumstances.
Okay.
And you have droughts in some areas. You have probably overpopulation in quite a number of areas. There's endemic warfare in some areas. But it's spotted all over the region at different times. And so what happens is that you can't really put your finger on it, but the ultimate conclusion is that you have a whole lot of unrest, a whole lot of problems, and they're all kind of coming together, and parts of the Maya Empire are sort of falling apart one by one, and the whole thing took about 150, 200 years, and when it was over, you had pretty much an empire in ruins.
Our guest is Guy Gugliotta, the author of The Maya Glory and Ruin in National Geographic's August edition. What is it about the Maya? I know that some people have said that there is no other people in history have taken such an interest in time as the Maya did.
I'm not sure that that's the case, but they certainly based an awful lot of their civilization on their ability to reckon time and to do it in a very, very studied way. I mean, they understood the North Star. They understood a lot about astronomy. They tracked some of the planets, and they had an entire astrology for that they used to schedule their important events. To make war, perhaps, to get married, and as the calendar unfolded, certain dates would loom in the calendar that would be extremely important to them, some of them separated by even hundreds of years.
You've separated this text of this article into three parts. And tell us about how you chose to do that.
Right. Well, we had we've divided it up into the rise of the Maya, and then the Maya at in triumph, and then the fall of the Maya.
Mm-hmm.
And what we tried to do was to kind of pick on a particular event early in the Maya's rise to power that that we thought would was crucial to the expansion of Mayan power and opulence. And as you mentioned at the top of the show, we looked at the visit of a what turned out to be a very famous personage whose name was Siyajkak is the name in Mayan, but the translation would be fire is born. We figure he's a warlord, probably from Teotihuacan, a famous site out of Mexico, outside of Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
and the dominant power probably throughout Mesoamerica at the time we're talking about, which is about, in our time, is about 370 A.D. And what we kind of determined was that Siyajkak, or as fire is born, comes to fairly important city-state in the Maya region, and forges an alliance and with the local chieftains, local Mayan chieftains. Then they go on to conquer the very, very large city-state of Tikal. And Tikal is a very famous Maya site, and it is also one of the pinnacle sites as far as, or one of the pinnacle places as far as organization and splendor. And from that beginning, we sort of decided that it's probably there in Tikal where the Maya decide, or where the Maya decide to go on kind of wars of conquest to bring the rest of the region and the other city-states into the fold, so to speak. I think we chose this event because over the last 4 or 5 years, it has sort of loomed as an important thing, and it wasn't regarded as that important, say, 10 years ago, because the scholarship in all of this is evolving very, very quickly. And so things change. There's new information coming, becoming available constantly. And so the picture sort of alters every 2 or 3 years, and this is where we are now. So we have this chieftain from southern or from Mexico coming into the Maya world, forging a military alliance, and then using that military alliance to conquer the biggest state in the Maya world at the time, and then that state in turn becoming the most important state in the entire Maya region.
When we're talking about populations, what kind of numbers are we talking about? Thousands? Millions? What do you take away from this?
That's a really interesting question. I think at the time we begin our story, probably about 370, 380 A.D., we're probably talking about maybe 2 or 3 million people in the Maya world altogether, most of them living in a rainforest environment.
Mm-hmm.
As time passes and we go to 2, 3, 4 centuries up till about 800 A.D. or 1,000 A.D., 6 centuries, estimates range up to about 20 million people in the rainforest. This is an extremely delicate environment. 20 million people in the rainforest is a lot of people. It's it's an incredible number of people, and it's many, many more people than live there today.
How did these populations stay alive? What were they doing in terms of, were they farming?
Yes. Instead, what people generally believe is that each city-state and the Maya world was kind of divided up into individual city-states that dotted the landscape. Each city-state had its own very intensive agricultural methods, and these evolved over time. You started with slash and burn. You came in and you cut down all the brush and all the trees, and then you planted corn and squash and chocolate, cocoa, and then your population grew, and then you couldn't do that anymore, and so you began to do more and more intensive kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
building gardens using swamp mud and terracing, all kinds of techniques, and some of them very sophisticated, but never on a grand scale. In other words, you never have the huge production agriculture like you'll have in highland civilizations, like we're seeing around in the Teotihuacan era. What you had were just individual city states sort of maintaining themselves using their own techniques. I don't think people recognize or think that there was huge surpluses to be traded around and from one region to another.
They must have hunted as well, hunted and gathered.
Definitely hunted and gathered, but I think less so as time passed, because once you have 10, 15, 20 million people in the rainforest, you don't have a whole lot of unoccupied territory. I think it's important to understand for those of our listeners, you know, who have been to the rainforest, who have visited Guatemala or southern Mexico, is that at the height of the Maya civilization, it didn't look anything like it looks now. It would have been largely cleared out. There would have been causeways and roads all over the place. People settled in large towns, towns of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, even 100,000 people. And you would have had lots and lots of people. It would have been cleared out. It wouldn't have looked anything like it looks now. So there's that, and that would cut down on the on the game available, but they did have game parks where they would raise animals and kill them kill them for food.
Mm-hmm. Guy Gugliotta is the author of The Maya Glory and Ruin: Saga of a Civilization in Three Parts: The Rise, the Monumental Splendor, and the Collapse. And it's in the National Geographic August edition. A great story with wonderful pictures. And a map that gives you an idea of where Maya civilization took hold, where it began, and essentially where it ended. And we'll talk more, and we'll take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the Maya culture and civilization with Guy Gugliotta, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. If you've ever visited one of the Mayan ruins, or if you have questions about Mayan culture and what they were able to accomplish, give us a call. The lines are open for you right now. Guy, I know that one of the things that we've not talked about, we're able to know about this character Fire is Born because of the large number of relics that have been left behind, ceramics, murals, sculpture, all telling the story. And as you say, in the last few years, we've begun to understand more and more of what the culture was about.
Yes, that's true. Fire is Born is commemorated in several tablets. They're called stelae, and they are limestone carvings that are all bedecked with Mayan characters and dated, and they describe important events in the ruling class of the Maya. The Maya script was first kind of decoded, probably, I think, began in the 1950s and the 1960s. And it's important to know that the ability to read Maya script and the ability to translate it and to understand it is an evolving thing. The epigraphers, people who study this script are called, have websites where they try out inscriptions and try out translations of inscriptions and suggest and mail them around to their friends so that everybody who studies this stuff can kind of think about it and maybe come back with other interpretations. So what happens, as I say, is that for long periods of time, you may have inscriptions that you understand or you think you understand, but then somebody may get a breakthrough and figure out exactly what something means. Siaj Kaak, who we know his name now, was born of fire. He was known for a long time as simply a smoking frog because the symbols of his name were a frog on fire. And we now know, though, that a frog symbolizes birth or generation, so that smoking frog is no longer the accurate name, and it was never the accurate name. It was a nickname for him because that was all that the epigraphers had. But now they know that his name did mean fire is born, and. So this is the way it develops. The inscriptions in many cases are there for a long time, and people, epigraphers and scholars, do understand them, but they can always understand them better, and they're always working to understand them better. So what you have of Fire is Born is you have records of him in Tikal, you have records of him in Waqa, this early city-state where he went, records of him in Washaktun, records of him in Copan, and his trajectory is, he went to a lot of places, and his arrivals and his stays in these places were very well commemorated, and which tells us that he was an extremely important person.
Very interesting. Let's take some phone calls. The lines are filling up, and so let's start hearing what the audience has to say. Mark in Waukesha is first. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi. I was wondering if you could compare the Aztec with the Maya. After seeing the Mel Brooks movie, which I thought was kind of interesting, I really can't highlight or compare the two civilizations.
All
so
right.
I was wondering if you could share some insights into their differences and so on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sure. You mean the Mel Gibson movie, I take it. Is
mm-hmm.
that,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things to know is that the Maya had disappeared pretty much. They were in decline by the time the Aztecs appeared. And it's the Maya is generally believed to have begun, say, about 2,000 years B.C., and to have pretty much been in decline, and the major civilization was pretty much gone by 1,000 A.D. Now, the Aztecs, as we know, were in place when the Spaniards arrived in the 1500s. The Maya were long gone at that point. Now, the Aztecs were had begun as sort of a cult of priests, and they had established hegemony over other tribes and other peoples on the Mexican plateau. They were based in what is now Mexico City, and their capital city was, in fact, Mexico City. It was called Tenochtitlan. And one of the reasons that they were pretty easy to topple by a very small number of Spaniards was that their subjugated peoples hated them so much because of their reliance on human sacrifice. And so it was easy for the Spaniards to get allies. Again, the Maya were completely apart, is a completely different story.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Dave, let's give you a chance to get in. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to relate my experience with the wonderful Mum family. Mum being one of the tribes, as I understand it. My understanding is very limited, but I did work side by side with this man through a relief agency here in the States. We were actually teaching him some barefoot dentistry, if you will. And my experience with this man, working side by side with him for about 2 years, included him getting the news of two brothers that were murdered by the Guatemalan government. I'm not really sure I want to go into why the government was so threatened by these people. It might have been just specific to him and his work experience in Guatemala. And he left, and he was here on asylum. But, you know, I guess what I wanted to say was it was just wonderful hearing this man speak the Mum dialect, even though he spoke Spanish and some English, enough English to get by. I was going to ask basically the same question as the previous caller did about the accuracies of the of Mel Gibson's movie. I guess that was a pretty good answer. I'm definitely going to read your book. I'm very inspired to read your book. Is there any insight? Can you give me any insight as to why these people were still persecuted? This was in 1981.
Right. Again, that's not really a question about Mel Gibson's movie. In 1981, and again, this is a completely different context. In 1981, Guatemala was an incredibly violent place. There had been a guerrilla war there since the mid-1960s. That between leftists per se and rightists per se for control of the country. And what had happened in 1981 was pretty much the worst year. And during that year, 1980-81, the guerrilla organizations reached, I guess, probably the height of their power. The main one was called the Guerrilla Army of the Poor, and another one was called the Organization of the People in Arms. And they were fighting an extremely, very conservative, very right-wing Guatemalan government. Both armies were filled with Maya, with indigenous people, and they fought each other pretty much for the control of the hearts and minds of the Mayan people, who are the descendants of the Maya. And during that period, the government, in particular, did in fact kill an awful lot of indigenous in hopes of crushing the guerrilla uprising and taking control of the country and finishing off the rebellion. They were fairly successful. The governments that came after were more successful. What happened was that the guerrilla groups and the government of Guatemala, which had evolved into a democratic government of Guatemala, signed a peace treaty. And again, I am going to not be too accurate, but I believe it was in 1998, but I'm not precisely sure. And it's been, it's not nearly as violent a place as it used to be, but that would be hard. It was about the most violent place I've ever been.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. I hope we're able to provide that knowledge for you. Again, the article that we're talking about is in National Geographic, the August edition, Maya, How a Great Culture Rose and Fell. The picture on the cover, is that in Guatemala?
Yes, I believe it is.
And is that Tikal, perhaps?
That is, I believe, Tikal.
You have some field notes that accompanied your article, and you talk about setting out for Tikal on your first day in the, is it the Pitan jungle?
Pitan. The Pitan jungle.
Mm-hmm. You have a guide, and talk about what that trip was like.
Oh, God. Well, I think the thing that is just overpowering, and I knew this going in, is that it's just incredibly hot. And I went in what sort of passes for the edge of the dry season, and so that you don't get the rain and you don't get the rain and the insects, but you still the temperature is mid 90s all the time, and it looks like it feels like mid 90s humidity all the time. It's just fairly awesome. And so when we went to Tikal, Tikal is just about the most elegantly restored site in Guatemala, and it's a big tourist attraction, and people go out there all the time. You walk around the site, and so the first thing that I did with my guide is we stopped at a roadside gas station and bought three huge bottles of water. And so I thought, well, you know, I thought we'd eat at the snack bar or something, or get Cokes out of the machine or something like that. So we drove into the parking lot, went into the park, and started to look at the Maya stuff. And I realized there are no soft drink machines, there is no cafeteria, there is no restaurant, there isn't anything except the ruins and. The text and the signs and everything that kind of accompany them. And we were following around and looking at this map that I had, and it was just brutal. And we were there for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and I was just soaked in sweat from shoulders to knees. And and it took me a good couple hours after we left to recover from this. And so in the ensuing days, each trip we made got longer and longer until we actually went to a little place called Waka, which is not that far from Tikal. But this required basically 7 hours of walking, 3.5 hours up, 3.5 hours back. But by that time, I'd pretty much gotten used to it, and so I devised a bunch of tricks. First of all, in your day pack, don't take anything you don't need. And second, if you're traveling with somebody like I was, this guy about 30 years old, I'm not 30, so make sure that he carries two bottles of water and you carry one, and then drink yours first. And then it's a whole lot easier. Anyway, it is brutal physically to go visit these places, but definitely worth the trip.
Guy Gugliotta is our guest. Nancy's next from La Crosse. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I had the opportunity to visit in the Yucatan Peninsula in the 30s and went to Palenque and Uxmal, Chichen Itza, Tulum, and then went into the interior to a place that really hadn't been touched much at all called Coba. And I was impressed by these roads that they had, the system of roads. They seemed to be built up. And yet I believe that the Mayans never had the wheel, nor, I don't know, did they have any kind of animals that hauled things around, or how did they, what did they use these big roads for? How did they manage to move things?
Good point. You're right on both counts. They did not have the wheel, and they didn't have draft animals to speak of. They used human beings, and they built these wide causeways, and they carried stuff, and they did it the hard way, and they used large numbers of people to transport to transport objects long ways. Also, keep in mind, this is not as true in the Yucatan where you were, but it is fairly true elsewhere, is that there are lots of waterways in Maya country. And so it was always very easy, or pretty easy, to get reasonably close to where you needed to go by water, and then to carry it the last little bit.
Contrast your visit to Tikal with that of going to Chichen Itza, let's say, and contrast what you would saw there in Tikal with what I would see in Chichen Itza in Mexico.
I think you would see... That's difficult. I think it would be hard for you to tell the difference without knowing. Chichen Itza is a very famous post-classic site.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the rainforest. It's on the. It would be in the rainforest if the area were not so built up. It's just outside of a city called Mérida, which is the main city in the Mexican Yucatan, and. If you fly to Mérida and drive to Cancun, you'll go right past it. And it's a very elaborate site. It does not have and never had long count dates or script, and because it is, as I say, a post-classic site. And Tikal, by contrast, is, I think we've talked about, in the heart of the rainforest. And Tikal is... a site that was pretty much abandoned about 300 years before Chichen Itza was built up. And Chichen Itza, I think, his heyday was about probably 1200 AD, whereas Tikal was pretty much destroyed by about 900 AD.
When I visited Chichen Itza about four and a half years ago, I think it was in December of 2002, I was also struck by how hot it was, just impossibly hot. But we were taken in an air-conditioned motor coach from our hotel and stopped at a little Mayan village where we met a Mayan couple. They were probably all of 5'4 and 5'3 and had three sons who had moved to Mexico City and had no interest in coming back there to live. But the guide that we had was friends with the sons, and so he had this arrangement whereby people who he had under his care then could stop, take pictures, meet these people, see what they lived like. And they lived very much like peasants with a thatched roof hut and had an extension cord running to their little site, had a water hose coming for fresh water. But it was really like living hundreds of years ago.
That sounds right, and it's even tougher down in the rainforest because there's not a lot of services. I mean, as you know, I mean Chichen Itza is pretty close to civilization,
mm-hmm.
and definitely reachable. But you go down to Tikal and many of these other places, and they're just the pretty much encampments and in tiny villages. And as I say, during the age of the Maya Empire, it would have been much more urbanized, because in Guatemala there's only about 300,000 people in the entire Petén, and just a fraction of what there were 1,500 years ago.
Our guest is Guy Gugliotta, the author of The Maya, Glory and Ruin, Saga of a Civilization in Three Parts. It's in National Geographic's August edition, and you can get more by going to nationalgeographic.com/NGM. And we'll take more of your calls and continue to talk with Guy Gugliotta about the Mayan Empire and civilization in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about the Maya civilization. And let's go back to the phones. If you'd like to join in, we have a couple of lines open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. John is in Green Bay with a question. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call, Jim. And Mr. Gugliotta, I was in Shadow Mall in Mexico, and I was at the Museum of the Maya. Would you critique it a little bit for me? And also, one little other question was, I saw a page or two of the Codex, and I understood that most of it was destroyed by the Spanish, burned by the Spanish, but they kept kind of referring to some of it was in Amsterdam or Brussels. Am I wrong on that, or whatever? Could you explain that for me?
Yeah, sure. I'm afraid I can't talk with you about the museum at Chetumal. I haven't been there. But about the codexes or codices, I can tell you, I think, a bit. Not Amsterdam, Berlin is one. They're named after the cities where they were taken. And what happened was that your guide or the museum is quite right. The Maya had written these large books of describing their civilization and their history, and at the behest in part of the Spaniards, and then the Spaniards began to destroy and destroyed virtually all of these. Three or four of them survived, and they became the basis of the ability to learn how to decode the Maya language and translate it. One of them is called the Codex Berlin, and or the Berlin Codex, and then there are other codices as well, and. So what happened was that in parts of these had text alongside the Maya text that was in Latin. You've probably heard of the Rosetta Stone and how they translated the hieroglyphics of the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
This was sort of the same thing, and they had Latin text and a little Spanish text that went with some of the codex material. So then they were able to decipher some of the symbols, and from that, they kind of peeled it away, and bit by bit. And the very famous scholar who began doing this was actually a Soviet woman in the 1960s. A woman named Proskuryakov, I think, was the first of the great epigraphers to do this. And it was a matter not so much of looking at the codex, but of gathering, looking at all the codices and being able to compare them all, because what you had were just sort of fragments left over, and almost everything else had, as you correctly pointed out, been destroyed.
John, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Suzanne in Scandinavia next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I'm calling. I'm sometimes concerned when Maya civilization is referred to as gone. The Maya are gone because I know Guatemala and the Yucatan today are full of Maya, and somehow, you know, quite a number survived, but I've never been able to find any information on the time that the great civilization collapsed up until, maybe the 20s or 30s. Do you have any idea?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's one of the that's part of the article here is pretty much about what we know about the collapse, when it occurred, and where and how. And by the collapse, you point out quite rightly that that Maya country, or the Maya country, is in fact populated by the descendants of Maya. So the Maya haven't disappeared. They're still there. They just don't live the way they lived 1,500 years ago. What happened, what we think happened, is a number of things. Beginning at about 800 AD and lasting probably until about 1000, even 1100 AD. The city-states of the Maya began to fight each other in ways that were not typical of what had gone before. At the pinnacle of Maya civilization, there were a number of wars, sort of ritually fought wars, in which alliances were made and broken, territory was annexed, but large numbers of people don't appear to have been killed. Yes, I mean, you would kill your rival kings, but the individual city states would survive, and they would just simply graduate from one empire or from one leader to another. But then, beginning about 800 AD, what you had was the systematic destruction of sites, and nobody knows. Can quite figure out why that happened, but it's clear that there's drought, that there's overpopulation, that there might have been epidemic disease, people may have not had enough to eat, famine, and that the rulers who were divine rulers were no longer providing what they were supposed to provide. And if you're divine and you're not delivering the goods, your future is limited. What happened, or what appears to have happened, is that at different times, sort of large-scale and very brutal wars broke out, in which one city-state would attack another city-state, and instead of capturing the leaders and getting rid of the leaders and then annexing the city-state, they would destroy the opposing city-state to such a degree that it would be uninhabitable. People would flee the losing state, go to other places, and then the losing state would just lie in ruins, and lies in ruins today. So this whole evolution took place, as I say, from about 800 AD to 1100 AD, and when it was over, you had post-classic sites like Chichen Itza and others that were quite splendid, but smaller, not nearly as opulent not nearly as opulent as the empire states of say Tikal or Calakmul or Copan or any of these states, which lay in ruins at that point. The Maya civilization never recovered. The Maya, as we know them, are in fact the indigenous people of Guatemala and southern Mexico and parts of Honduras and Belize. But the way they live is not the way the Maya civilization lived when it was at its peak.
Suzanne, thank you very much for that call and point of view. Let's go to Stephen next in Green Bay. Stephen, what's on your mind today?
I have two questions. One is, because of the Mel Gibson movie, there's a misconception in a lot of people's minds that the Maya were into human sacrifice, and wanted to know if that is in fact a false misconception or if that's true. And second, it's famously known that the Mayan calendar supposedly comes to a halt, an end, in 2012. And wanted to know what this gentleman had to make of that. I've heard that at the height of their civilization, they were quite astute astronomers, and perhaps they were in touch with some type of astrological cycle, and he could determine... And they were able to determine that in 2012, some sort of significant epoch comes to an end, and then another one begins. I just want to know what he knew about that.
All right, Guy?
Sure. First, on the the Mel Gibson movie. The Maya did do human sacrifice, almost for sure. I don't think they didn't do it with the ritual abandon that the movie portrays. I think that I don't know, several movies that I've seen of that Europeans make about Latin America always focus on these kind of grisly details. I didn't particularly like the movie. I didn't think it was particularly accurate, and I thought it was sort of aimless. It didn't seem to me to have any plot. One of the nice thing, the interesting thing about it was that it was in Mayan, and the language they spoke was it is one of the Mayan languages that are spoken today. As far as the world ending in 2012, I didn't know that was the date, and I'm not going to be totally accurate when I describe how this works, but pretty much everything you say is in fact the way that the Maya thought of things. They had their calendar was divided up into individual pieces, and then those were put into larger pieces and larger pieces. How do I describe this? It's like we have days, months, and years. They had days, months, and years. Their years were different from ours, but then after years, they would have, instead of decades, I believe they had a 13-year cycle. Again, don't hold me to this. I don't have this at my fingertips, but they had a very elaborate calendar that spread out through very, very long periods of time, and so that one of these very, very important dates every 300 or 400 years was imminent or would arrive, that had great significance for the Maya, some archaeologists believe that the Maya geared some of their major events to these dates, and that some of the catastrophes that befell the Maya later on had something to do with the timing and the imminence of significant dates. Now, 2012, I'm not sure that's the date, but if you were running the calendar out far enough, then 2012 would be a date for a particularly significant or catastrophic event. If so, you know, stay tuned.
Stephen, thank you very much for the call. Talking about the Maya civilization and culture, they were accurately precise as far as astronomical cycles go. They developed a great mathematical system of 0 and 1 and 10. They had Maya writings, Maya calendar. You mentioned the long count, the sacred calendar. There is so much to the Maya civilization that is phenomenal. And one of the things that I really treasure is that when my wife and I visited Chichen Itza, we were able to obtain our wedding date in the Mayan. So we have a Mayan script, the pictures designating the date of September 12, 1981, and it is something that we treasure as something from the past that is really still current today.
Sounds right to me.
What is your next article for National Geographic? Have you got one in mind?
Well, I actually have one in the can, so to speak. It's going to be in print, it's going to be in the October issue. It's the 50th anniversary of space travel.
Very interesting. One of the things that I noticed in the pictures accompanying your article was that they were all taken at night. And was there a particular reason to do that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. Because if you notice the pictures, you'll see that what the photographer did was he put light inside the ruins and had the light projecting outward into the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had you have the ruins glowing from the interior, creating this spectacular effect that you see in the portfolio.
The map is excellent in showing the timeline of Mayan culture, beginning more or less coming from the Pacific Ocean southeast of Guatemala, and then moving up through Guatemala, Mexico, a bit into Honduras, and then into the Yucatan Peninsula. It's a very wonderful map. It gives you an idea of the sort of timeline of development there.
Yeah, right. I think so. One thing that people don't tend to focus on a lot is that the Maya civilization, or the pre-classic Maya, probably had its finest expression in the highlands. And one of the very famous pre-classic sites is, in fact, the city is Guatemala City today. And and one of the lingering mysteries, and one of the things that that really puzzle people today, is how and why the Maya ended up in the rainforest.
Guy, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us for the hour. Guy Gugliotta, the author of The Maya, Glory and Ruin. You find it in National Geographic in the August 2007 edition. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.